welcome to What About the Canadians, a podcast about Canadian history. My name's Shauna.
And my name is Ashley, and we're two rookie historians bringing to you the Canadian history you should know.
This season, we'll be discussing World War I through a Canadian perspective.
More specifically, we will examine the battles the Canadians served in. All right. Welcome back, everybody. It's been a hot minute, but we are back to bring you all the excitement of 1918.
Woo!
We're nearing the end. We're getting there. Now, before we get into it, we've mentioned on a previous podcast that I had planned to go to Europe. Now, I've come and gone, and I have to say the trip was absolutely incredible. I had the best time. Didn't get to do a ton of stuff surrounding, like, Canadian history, but, Shauna, I made it work out so Tyler and I could go to Vimy Ridge.
Oh, yes. I'm so glad you got there again.
Yeah, it was awesome.
I'm not jealous at all. That's fine.
It was really great. Although I have to say Tyler's reaction wasn't quite what I expected. His first words when we got there were, "I thought the monument would be bigger." And I'm just like, how big do you want this monument? Like, it's huge.
So he didn't cry like you did the first time?
No, he didn't.
Did you cry this time?
I didn't, no. I wasn't as emotional this time around. Because I knew what I was expecting.
Oh, I was going to say that's because I wasn't there. But yeah, oh, well, you know, or you knew.
That too. But we did the tunnel tour again. And this time we didn't get to see the carvings in the tunnels.
Oh, no.
I don't know why they skipped over that.
For those that don't know, if you do the tour at Vimy, they have all these like carvings that the soldiers did, and there's little Canadian flags and everything and people's names, and it's really a cool piece of history there.
Yeah. But no. They did not show us that. So that was disappointing. Because I thought that was like one of the cooler parts of the tunnel.
Maybe they're like refurbishing it or something.
Maybe. Or maybe it's getting damaged. I can't see how it would be, but I don't know. Anyway, so yeah, it was super cool. And I have to say, I was still equally confused about where the lines were. I had no freaking clue. Because I'm like looking at the Canadian trenches, and then they showed us like where the German trenches were. And then I'm like, I'm just so lost. Because like at Vimy, we talk about how, especially like for the 3rd and 4th Division, because it's like Hill 145 and then you have the Pimple, right? So you're expecting to see like a fairly steep incline, but It's just not clear to me at all. And I mean, maybe it's because it's all surrounded and stuff by trees now. It's not as obvious. I really have no idea. Because I was kind of expecting, like, when I went to the monument, because you can look down, right? When you're at the Malmy monument and you look down over the plain or whatever. Mm-hmm. But that wouldn't have aligned with the trenches. Like, I think that's running, like, east-west, whereas the trenches were more south. So, anyway, I was straight out confused. I'm like, I have no clue.
Well, now I'm very confused too. Thank you. Because I thought I had it in my head when we were doing that episode. You guys can go back and listen to that episode on Vimy Ridge there. But now that you're saying that, I have no idea.
Yeah, I don't either. So I have to do a bit more investigation on that. Like, I even asked the tour guide, I'm like, I am like so disorientated. Like, I can see the trench lines, like, that way is the, and it just didn't, I couldn't make it work in my head. It just didn't. But anyway, it was still super cool, so I was really happy we got to go.
That's great. I'm glad you guys got there.
Anyway, I did think of you on our trip, and I did get you just a little something silly. to remind you of the time when we went. So this is like one of the few things I could bring back because my suitcase was completely stuffed. So if you want to open it, go ahead.
Okay, so earlier today, Ashley dropped something off in my mailbox and she said I can't open it until now. So I've been pretty excited to see what this is. It feels a little bit weird. You can hear me unwrapping it. I have no idea. Oh! That's awesome. It's a can of, I'm going to pronounce it wrong, I'm sure, Chocomel?
Yeah.
Yeah, Chocomel. Yeah. Yeah. And it's Dutch, right? Yeah.
It's Dutch, yeah.
That's right. We had it in Holland when we were there. Yes.
Yeah, just for context, my best friend lived in Holland for a year, and Shauna and I went out to Europe and we visited her, and she was like raving about Chocomel. And so we had it like a couple times or whatever. And I can't remember if it was you or her when I left. She's like, oh, remember to get some Chocomel.
I think so that was like, her.
Oh, it must have been her. So I was just like, okay, I'll bring some back.
That's perfect. Thank you.
You're welcome.
I'll share it with the kids.
I wanted to bring back macarons, but I don't know if they would have fared well.
No, probably not.
Probably not. And I have to say, I don't think you're missing out. I think the ones from Alia in Calgary are just as good.
Oh, really?
Yeah.
Oh, good. Okay. Well,
so you're not missing out. You're not missing
maybe
out.
I'll go get some macarons and have some Chocomel.
Yeah. There you go.
Awesome.
Yeah.
That was anyway, very unexpected. Thank you.
You're welcome. All right. So now we should talk about like the reason that we're here.
Yeah. Let's segue from Chocomel to the war.
The war.
I don't know how that's going to go, but let's do it. Hard right here.
All right. So we're entering the last leg of the war. But before we close out 1917, let's travel on the Memory Express back to the Russian home front. Now, the bourgeois liberal leaders of the provisional government had unwittingly authorized Lenin's entry into the country despite warnings from British station border guards. But the provisional government's ineptitude for foresight extended well beyond the admittance of a known Bolshevik insurgent into the country. While the provisional government may have succeeded in disbanding the imperial secret police and granting freedom of the press, it failed to address the most critical concerns of the Russian proletariat and soldier, and that was peace, bread, and land. Now, this was the perfect breeding ground for Lenin to push his socialist agenda. Now, long story short, Lenin and the Bolsheviks encouraged an insurrection. The Bolsheviks overthrew the provisional government. There were some elections, some coalitions, some breakup of coalitions, some infighting, and an overhaul to the structure of the government. But the main point I'm trying to make here is that under the new socialist government, the war for Russia came to an end when they signed the Treaty of Brest-Litovsk. Oh, no.
Oh, that's a, yeah, good luck with that one.
Litovsk? I didn't even think to look that up.
You didn't Google this one first?
I did. Anyway, they signed a treaty on December 18th, 1917. Oh, good gracious. So the question is, what does this mean for the Canadians? It means Germany is no longer fighting a two-front war, and they can concentrate the vast majority of their resources to the Western Front. So this must have been like an oh moment for the Allies. I mean, especially because like the Americans haven't even arrived to the front in any sort of significant way per se, like numbers wise anyway, and reserve forces were in short supply. Like this was a critical issue come 1917-1918. So, you know, let's take a look at the numbers also. What does this all really mean? So by 1918, the Germans had 178 divisions on the Western Front compared to the 173 held by the Allies. So, obvious problem, right? Well, not exactly. Now, Allied divisions were larger than German divisions, at least like numerically speaking. So the Allies still had more soldiers, and that worked out to be roughly about 250,000 more. Plus, they had a more robust artillery and air force. But the Germans held superiority over the Allies with infantry-based weapons, the most crucial being that machine gun. Now, it's actually kind of interesting, while I was researching this episode, I was thinking to myself, what would I rather take my chances against? An artillery barrage or a machine gun? And I kind of thought to myself, I'd fare better against an artillery barrage.
Actually, that's what just popped into my head too. Yeah.
Yeah.
I think artillery.
Yeah. I was like, I'm just going to go underground and like wait this out.
Yeah.
But I actually came to learn that I'm perhaps not so savvy, because historians estimate that 50 to 66% of deaths were actually due to artillery fire.
Oh.
Super surprising to me.
Yeah.
So I've come to learn, like, come, like, zombie apocalypse, I'm not surviving. Like, I don't have an aptitude for this sort of thing. Anyway, so the two forces are pretty, like, I'll say even-ish, despite, like, the influx of German soldiers to the front. But we can't really discount the fact that the Allies haven't been able to break through the German line in 4 years. Now, in recent battles where the Allies were outnumbered by the Germans, the Allies outnumbered the Germans, like 3-2, Allied defenses were constantly being beat back. And this understandably caused some alarm against the Allied commanders. Now, by March of 1917, the British were holding about 202 kilometers of the front with 59 divisions, and the French were holding 482 kilometers with 97 of their divisions. Now, the Belgians had 10 divisions, and they were largely holding the Yser front, and they were doing this for most of the war. And now there was about maybe only 5 American support divisions thrown in there as well. So throughout the winter of 1917 and 1918, the Germans were beginning to prepare for a large-scale offensive, which we now know is codenamed Operation Michael. Now, their objective was to break through the line where the British and French armies met. Now, once achieved, they could launch larger-scale attacks at Saint-Quentin, Arras. Oh, I googled this one. I think it's Armentier. I don't know. Oh, I did Google it and then I forgot. And Ypres or Ypres?
I've always said Ypres.
Yeah, okay, we'll go with Ypres. I can't remember. And their objective here was to drive the British towards the seaports. Now, this is, think of it as kind of like making the British walk the plank. They either have to face the sword or the sea. So they're just basically trying to encircle them, so they had nowhere else left to go. Now, the British were aware of the impending offensive attack, and they did prepare their lines. Yet, the officers left their men largely ill-positioned. Now, unlike the Germans, two-thirds of British forces were bound to what they called strong points. So that meant only a third were left in maneuverable positions. So it made it much more difficult for the British to launch any sort of counterstrike or move to cover gaps in the line. Now, the overwhelming strength of the Germans would soon become apparent. Now, Operation Michael commenced with a bombardment at 4:40 a.m. on the 21st of March, 1918. Over a 400 square kilometer territory. And this lasted for about 6 hours. So this is pretty standard by this time in the war. It's what we expect. Now, unfortunately, to the detriment of the British, a thick fog had rolled in, leaving it near impossible to detect the incoming infantry. And because of this, much of the forward zones were lost. And this bout of bad luck was certainly a costly one, as the British lost around 40,000 men that day. Now, that's almost as much as the Somme.
Yeah, that's huge.
Yeah, not a good start. Now, this fog continued to impede defensive operations by the morning of day two, forcing the British to retreat. Now, the Germans made pretty steady gains throughout the first 2 days, but the advance on day three and four was absolutely extraordinary. Now, I used kind of one of those distant calculators to figure out how much territory was gained, like just like one of those like app things on your computer. And from what I could kind of guess, it looked like to me the Germans gained about over 20 kilometers in some areas on the like day two and three. So, and some battles where we're talking about like feet of gains, like 20 kilometers.
That's huge.
Is a lot.
Like usually it's just kind of measured in meters, I think.
Yeah. If you're lucky, it's like, oh yeah, we got a kilometer.
Yeah.
So this is big.
Mm-hmm.
Now, unfortunately, the front line of the BEF had become so fragmented that Brigadier General Sir James Edmonds recalled having to spend his nights simply just reorganizing the units because they were in just such disarray. Now, a British commander, General Haig, called on Pétain, and just as a reminder, that's the French commander, for reinforcements. But on the night of the 24th, the Germans launched an attack at Lyon, and with them, they brought a siege gun. And this particular gun could fire up to 75 miles. Now, Lyon is within that kind of range of Paris, so it was just getting a little too close for comfort for the French. Now, Pétain was ordered by the government to protect Paris at all costs, so he just couldn't spare any more reinforcements to cover this weakening gap between the British and French lines. Now, Pétain was also anticipating a large-scale attack in Champagne, so he sought to secure the region despite knowing the Germans, again, could create this gap between the armies. Now, unfortunately for him, like, he didn't really know that an attack was not like imminent. It wasn't directly on the table, but the Germans were purposely giving the impression that they were preparing for one. So you can give him like a little bit of a pass there. Because like, obviously you got to prepare like on all fronts. However, our good old friend Haig thought this was total BS, because he's like, if the line breaks, we're not going to like win the war, man. Like, what are you doing? So in desperation, Haig turned to the Supreme War Council for help. Now, the question is, what is the Supreme War Council?
Sounds very serious.
It does. So again, we're going to have to back up a little bit to November of 1917. So as we know, things aren't going like super stellar for the Allies in any of the theaters. I mean, it was generally accepted that Britain was safe from invasion, but France and Italy continued to be vulnerable, and that vulnerability could only be warded off through certain protective measures. Now, one of those protective measures was to streamline joint efforts on the front by creating a united council that would be responsible for managing sort of like the high-level strategy and the deployment of Allied forces. Now, on the one hand, this might seem kind of surprising because you'd be like, well, why would one country like give up control to another? But the main players had their reasons. First, for the French Prime Minister, Paul Panlevy, he wanted to force the British to take over a greater sector of the front lines, just to relieve pressure on the French. His hope was that General Foch, who was the army chief of the general staff, would take over the British-French reserve forces to help enforce this. Now, on the other hand, British Prime Minister Lloyd George was eager to oust the chief of Imperial General Staff, Sir William Robertson, And Haig just simply wanted a commitment to a joint offensive on the Western Front. I think at this point he's just like, we need to work together to get this done. Now, although he was replaced by Prime Minister Clemenceau in November of 1917, but Clemenceau, he also supported the adoption of the council. But his ambition was to place a French leader as like the supreme commander, or what it was to become known as the Generalissimo, which is like the coolest
Generalissimo?
Name.
Yes. That sounds very Italian.
That's what I thought too. But that was his title.
All right.
Yeah. So he wanted the French to come into control over this position. So, I mean, to summarize, what I'm trying to say is the supreme commander would have the power over strategic. They'd have the power over the strategic direction of the military operations over the Allied forces, like in general. Whereas Pétain and Haig would remain in control of like the more localized like attacks and overall. So when Haig did go to the Supreme Council for assistance in March of 1918, the organization of the Supreme Council actually hadn't really been all that fleshed out yet. And in particular, the leadership role hadn't been all that well established. Now, Haig allegedly pushed for the promotion of Foch as the Supreme Allied Commander. And as I just said, like that works out perfectly for Prime Minister Clemenceau. And it turns out the heads of the council were in general agreement with the suggestion. And he was voted in as our Generalissimo. So this worked out great for Haig in his mind, because he immediately transferred command of the British 5th Army to the French to help reinforce the weaker lines. So jumping back into the battle, by day 6 of Operation Michael, the Germans had now gained up to 40 kilometers into Allied territory. But for some kind of strange reason, they only gained maybe another 20 within the next 10 days. So things were slowing down for them. So could be these reinforcements were finally doing their job. Now, the Germans' attempt to break through the line at Arras and take Vimy Ridge had actually also failed. So again, the question is why? Now, Ludendorff blamed the failure on his untrained troops, whereas contemporary journalists attributed the failure to Ludendorff's decision to deviate from his original plan. But to the German General Chief of Staff, it was both and yet neither. In reality, their objectives were probably just too ambitious, and they underestimated the Allies' defenses. Now, what had come to be known as the March Offensive, Germany had taken a vast amount of Allied territory, but the losses were enormous. Now, the Germans had 239,000 casualties, and the British suffered about 163,000, and the French about 77,000. So these numbers were enormous.
They are. I was just like, my eyes went so wide hearing those numbers. It's so crazy that there were that many people that, you know, and there were still people left.
Yeah, it's gross. If you think about it, it's just crazy. Now, this is a Canadian history podcast, and what we want to know is, what role did the Canadians play during this battle? Well, luckily, it was a small one. Now, the Canadian Corps was stationed with the British First Army away from the battlefront. So we were largely safe from what was going on during the time. However, there were a couple units that were called upon, and one of them was the cavalry. Now, for the most part, the cavalry units kind of bounced around quite a bit, not only between different locations, but also under different commands. And what I mean by that is, like, under some situations, they were under British command, and then other situations they were under French command. And this was all having to do with that Allied Council to help like coordinate units more effectively along the front. Now, one of the larger skirmishes the Canadians faced was at Moriel and Rifle Wood. Now, this was a critical point near the Amiens and Paris Railway. So on the morning of the 29th, the Royal Canadian Dragoons charged forward, but unfortunately, they were met with machine gun fire. Now, those that were able to reach the wood dismounted and hid for covering amongst the saplings. Now, on the east flank, Lord Strathcona's horse took a more direct perch, we'll say. Led by Lieutenant Gordon Flowerdew, they just went full on old school cavalry style. They charged the Germans head on with their sabers in the air, and like they were screaming at the top of their lungs. And the Germans hightailed it out of there.
I bet you Haig loved that, didn't he?
He probably did.
He's always wanted the cavalry to break through a line and just like keep going for it. And this isn't exactly it, but I bet you he was pretty excited.
He probably was very proud. Now, unfortunately, Flowerdew and his horse were fatally wounded, but one of his men heard him yell before his death, "Carry on, boys, we have won." But as one would expect in this sort of situation, the losses were tremendous. The casualty rate of this charge was about 70%. But for their heroism, two of the men were actually awarded the Victoria Cross, and this included Lieutenant Flowerdew. Now, the woods were lost and retaken several times, but by the morning of April 1st, Rifle Wood was securely in the hands of the Canadians, but unfortunately, they just couldn't secure Moriel. Now, the units of the 1st Canadian Motor Machine Gun Brigade had also been deployed to the 5th Army on the second day of the battle to hold up lines northwest of Perrone Road. Now, they brought with them 8 armored vehicles and 40 machine guns. But unfortunately, by the evening, the brigade only had 2 out of those 40 guns, and the remaining men were forced to fall back with the rest of the 5th Army. Now, the 1st Canadian Motor Machine Gun Brigade was also responsible for patrolling the highways around Villiers-Bretonneux, which, according to Colonel Nicholson, was well beyond the scope of its capacity, considering the small size of the unit. But, of course, they performed their job effectively. Together with the Australians, they captured about 200 Germans and regained some lost ground just south of Villiers-Bretonneux. So it's kind of, there's a lot going on here, and I skirted over quite a bit because there's just a lot of detail going on. But I think the general feeling I have is that the March offensive was a close call. And halting that breakthrough did pretty much little to raise the average hopes of the soldier on the front. Now, I found a quote from a German gunner. He remembers hearing from some of the British POWs that, what did he say? They were in rather desperate condition. They all said nothing else but, "The war is over for us, and we don't want to go back anymore." So, morale is low. I mean, understandably. So, come into the second week of April, German forces were beginning to move north of the Scarpe. Now, Ludendorff intended to attack between Armentier, and Le Bas to break through the First Army and cut off important ports at Calais, Dunkirk, and Boulogne. Now, Haig was desperate for reinforcements, but Foch refused to send French troops from the south until the Germans launched their attack, thereby revealing their objective, basically. Now, exactly 1 year after the Battle of Vimy Ridge, on April the 9th, 1918, the Germans advanced, taking 5 kilometers of Allied territory with them. Now, by the next morning, Armentier and Mezenies had been captured. It was only then did Foch deploy French reserves to the lines, but he basically continued to refuse Haig's request for additional relief. I think he thought Haig was being a bit selfish. And he kind of basically told Haig to like kind of like man up, like, this is your position, this is what you're responsible for, like, manage it, kind of thing. And I think it's just because the French were also under like an extreme amount of pressure on the lines of as well. So things continued to not go so well. By the 19th of April, the Germans captured Villiers-Bretonneux and Moriel in its totality. Now, this momentum of the Germans allowed them to turn their attention now back to that Flanders region. Unfortunately, this time, the only reasonable course of action for the Allies was to shorten the line, meaning that that salient that we've talked about quite a bit at Ypres, which had been so hard fought for, was abandoned.
And oh no, they retreated that salient? It was like, that was so intense.
I know, it was so important to them.
Disappointing to hear.
Yeah. I think strategically it does make sense that they let it go. But yeah, after all their losses, it was kind of heartbreaking to read that. So once that kind of happened, the Germans refocused to south of Ypres. And they took Mount Kemmel from the French with pretty relative ease. But Foch ended up beefing up the sector with an extra 7 divisions, which stopped further advancement. Now, Ludendorff called off any further offensive for the month of April to give his men reprieve. Now, despite their success, German casualties at this point, we're talking like end of April, were now about 340,000. And this is really why Ludendorff gave his men a break. Like, even though you have success, it came at a cost. So while they're having a little bit of break, they head into the month of May.
So we'll jump into May, and we're going to call this period, I guess, the German advance to the Marne. So from May 27th to June 6th, things were heating up even more, and it was becoming like more critical because we're coming to the end of the war. The Germans are feeling the pressure here. Everybody's feeling the pressure. So where they are right now, there's an area between the Aisne River and the Marne in France. And General Ludendorff came up with a twofold plan here. First, there was a diversionary attack across the Aisne to draw French reinforcements away from Flanders. Then there was a major offensive against the British in the north once the French reserves were taken down. The German 7th Army, positioned along the Chemin des Dames, were trying to be sneaky, and they secretly increased the strength there by 30 divisions and 4,000 guns in the early parts of May. So on May 27th, the Germans launched a surprise attack, deploying 38 divisions with over 5,000 guns along a 60-mile front. They focused on the Chemin des Dames, a ridge held by minimal British and French divisions. It was pretty weakly defended, and their plan worked, and the French were super surprised. So the German assault on the Chemin des Dames was successful. 10 German divisions stormed the ridge, causing the collapse of the French and British divisions in the center. The German advance was quick with a 10-mile gain. What? Why do I have in miles there? That's ridiculous. What's 10 miles to kilometers? I can't believe I wrote miles. Was that like 22 kilometers or something like that? That's pretty big. Are you Googling it for me?
16.
Oh, that's it? Oh, okay. 60.
Yeah.
All right. Not as big as I thought, but still, that's pretty decent because that's only on the first day.
Yeah, it's a ton. I mean, like I said, like at the beginning of the war, we're talking meters, feet. Now we're talking like kilometers.
Yeah. Oh, I got some more miles here. Okay. So by the end, you can Google this one for me too. By the end of the second day, the Germans had advanced pretty significantly and they captured Soissons, and they established a pocket of territory, which was 15 miles deep. Again, I don't know, like 21 kilometers?
24.
24 kilometers and 40 miles wide.
I don't know. Oh, wow.
That's
okay. Yeah. 64 kilometers.
There you go. Yep. We'll listen to Ashley. Thank you for saving me there.
You're welcome.
So despite the success, though, Ludendorff's goal of diverting the French reinforcements from Flanders failed. General Foch, who was Ashley was talking about there with the overall Allied commander, recognized the real threat in the north and didn't actually weaken his reserves there. So the French and American divisions were drawn into the battle, but they came from reserves held by General Pétain. So the overall strength of the Allies was conserved and actually increased a little bit. So that totally failed for Ludendorff. Foch, according to historian Tim Cook, Foch made a lot of Churchillian speeches, he called it. I like that word. Sounds like chinchilla. But he made a lot of these speeches, I guess. And during this offensive, he said in rebuttal to the Germans attacking, "I shall fight in front of Amiens. I shall fight in Amiens. I shall fight behind Amiens. I shall fight all the time." Ooh. Very dramatic.
Yes.
So I know that so far what I've said here hasn't had a lot to do with the Canadians, but I just wanted to push this in here because we were talking about Foch. He was especially fond of the Canadians, and even though he had only formally inspected them once, he didn't really need to see it for himself because they had such a reputation. He said that the Canadian Corps was an army second to none, deriving its immense strength from the solid organizations of each of its components welded together in battle conditions. So pretty high praise from that man there.
Yeah.
So jumping back to Ludendorff here, his subsequent attempt to extend the diversion with an attack between, oh, this is a fun word, Ashley, Montdidier and Noyon also met with resistance. The German 18th Army launched an attack on June 9th, making initial gains, but eventually they were held back by the French 3rd Army. Foch responded promptly by sending reinforcements, including tanks and aircraft, to counter the German advance. While the counterattack didn't gain much ground, it really effectively halted the German progress, and Ludendorff eventually called off the attacks by June 12th. So the German advance to the Marne was it's a pretty complicated series of all these German attacks, and they really wanted to divert the French reinforcements and break through the lines. And while the Germans achieved the kind of tactical success, and they had some pretty big gains, their overall objective of weakening the North and drawing the French reserves was pretty much nothing. It didn't work for them. While this is going on, and the Canadians aren't really part of this section, they kind of are, but they're not really there. They were defending areas, and a lot of them were in reserves. So between March 21st and July 30th, they were just kind of, I don't want to say that they were just hanging out because that's not all they were doing, but they were having a bit of a rest. Their primary responsibility was to safeguard a 7-mile sector centered around Lens, which was a pretty strategic location now because it had a bunch of coal mines and communication hubs. So they wanted to keep that pretty safe. So to get ready for these German advances that they knew were coming, they were really upping their defensive measures. So the Canadians were part of trench construction and installing wire entanglements and making machine gun nests. And they also took care of positioning artillery and building new battery positions on Vimy and stockpiling ammunition. And the French loved this because that area is really important and they could count on the Canadians to defend that should it come and when it did come. As the German offensive kind of unfolded, the Canadian Corps was faced with a lot of changes. There were some pretty urgent requests made to deploy the Canadians as reserves for the pretty beat-up British. The 2nd Canadian Division was moved to serve with the British 6th Corps, and the 1st Division was withdrawn from the front lines to become a part of the 1st Army Reserve. Meanwhile, the 3rd Division relieved another British division. So the 2nd Division, a lot of numbers here, mainly focused on patrolling and having aggressive raids. And they were up there for 3 months and they carried out 27 raids. And they really had, they kept the Germans on their toes. They said that they were giving the Germans no peace. Their raiding techniques, they changed a little bit here, or they were, just became more aggressive, I guess. They considered it deep raiding because they would push through the first and second lines if they could, sometimes up to 1,000 meters into the German territory. And they would get to that third line and they were kind of given, I don't want to say carte blanche because that wasn't exactly it, but they killed a lot of Germans. And I saw a quote and I forgot to write it down, but it was something like, you could see a man laying there dead and that was fine. You knew where he was. But suddenly men would start disappearing from the German trenches and it really got in their heads. So they would just like pull guys out of the trenches quietly and take prisoners or kill them and just really freak out the Germans in general.
Right.
Yeah. And so they, as long as they could get in and out, it was kind of like, yeah, you know, scare them a little bit.
I was going to say totally. And that goes back to what we've been hearing about the Canadians all along. They're definitely more of the take no prisoners sort.
Yeah, they're still pretty rough out there. But since they were there for so long, they were there for 3 months, which actually is a long time to be in one place, it seems to be, in World War One. So there was some bitterness brewing. They had pretty heavy casualties, especially compared to the other Canadian divisions that weren't doing the same sort of job. So the bitterness kind of started with that, and then it grew because there was a rumor that they were there because they were being punished for some supposed crimes that they had committed. And that was mostly hardcore looting in Arras, which was completely false. And Curry said about it, the lie was spread so systematically that I believe it was done maliciously. So he actually thought that it was something being spread about by Beaverbrook, Hughes, and other supporters of Turner, who was ousted earlier. I think he was reassigned. I can't remember exactly where he went. But this was done to undermine Curry. But there's no proof of that. It's just kind of Curry, I think, protecting himself or being bitter. And
oh, that's interesting.
Yeah. There comes our boy Hughes again. What a jerk.
Yeah.
So Curry was, you know, still trying to keep the Canadians together. He thought, especially with all these problems going on, he wanted all his boys together so that would kind of calm down and the morale would kind of be bolstered a little bit more after all these rumors were spread. So they were just temporarily separated, but he kept fighting for them to come back together, and eventually they brought them back together because they saw how important that was. But there were some other changes going on, quite a few. The Canadian Machine Gun Corps was reorganized. Machine gun companies were restructured into two different battalions, each one equipped with additional companies. This was kind of to emphasize the tactical role of machine gun units, which the Germans had been doing very well with. So the machine gun companies were attached to infantry divisions to enhance their firepower. I think that was probably something they picked up on from the other side.
Yeah, and that seems logical.
Yeah, I would think so.
Yeah.
And then there was the engineers. They went through another reorganization to reduce their reliance on the infantry labor. There were three companies within each division, and they were expanded into a brigade with the goal of improving engineering efficiency and control. So they were just kind of beefing everything up, really. And then there was the motor branch of the Canadian Machine Gun Corps, and they were reorganized and they absorbed existing motor machine gun units. And this led to the establishment of two motor machine gun brigades with increased mobility. So again, bringing those machine guns out and making them a little bit more important there. But it wasn't all just like, you know, raiding and fighting and being petty with rumors. There was also, they had Dominion Day there, which is July 1st, so it's kind of like an early Canada Day, sort of.
Yeah.
They had track and field events, and there was a soccer championship, and I think there was a baseball game in there, too. The Prime Minister and the Corps Commander were there to watch the games, and they paraded in front of them with pipers and drummers to make it a real event. And to make sure everything stayed safe for the Prime Minister, some of the RAF were on patrol in the skies, and they actually had the ace Billy Bishop that I think Ashley spoke about in one of the episodes. I can't remember which one that was, but he was like the top ace of the whole Allied Army, or sorry, Air Force. Mm-hmm. He, by the end of the war, he was actually credited with 72 victories, and he got a Victoria Cross as well.
Yeah.
He was flying there, and he did stunts over the crowds and like was being a show off. So everybody loved that.
Speaking of like the flying corps, I did read it was during like the March April offensive that the Red Baron had been shot down.
Oh,
so kind of like his counterpart was now deceased.
Yikes. So Billy Bishop got to show off and got to survive, I guess.
Yeah. Woo! The ultimate win.
Yeah. So, and after Dominion Day, they also had the Highland Gathering, which was on July 6th. And that brought together all the Highland regiments from the Canadian Corps and the British Army. And they had, like, you know, the normal Highland game competitions, the cable tossing, those big caber. Logs? Caber tossing? Okay.
Yeah, caber.
The big logs. And they had a pipe band and all these, you know, Scottish stereotypes, I'm sure.
Yes.
But soon enough, the men were called back up to the front, and it was all about business again. So on July 15th, the Canadian Corps returned to the front lines, relieving the 17th Corps after a period of rest and training. However, the Corps' leadership knew that a new offensive operation was coming. So on July 22nd, a conference was held. You didn't talk about this one yet. To discuss a planned attack against Orange Hill east of Arras. This operation was presented as a cover for a different undisclosed attack elsewhere on the front. This kind of, from March to July, there was just a lot of rest and training and like a strange kind of lull for the Canadians, I guess.
Yeah, I was just thinking, like, we're already in July. Like,
yeah,
we went through, like, not that we went through that quick, but like, it fast forwarded really quickly.
Yeah, everything kind of like got on high alert, and now it's coming. The end is coming. Yeah. I was reading for this lull period, a lot of the soldiers that had been there for a long time were like, oh God, thank God we needed this. But the new people that were coming in were like, hey, come on. Let's get out there. Let's fight, you know, and they were like ready to go and they wanted this to go. And the old guys were like, take this when you can, because you haven't seen the worst of it.
Yeah.
And they're going to see some pretty bad stuff coming up. So part of the bad stuff coming up, it's not as bad as like the Somme or something like that, but was the last German offensive. And this was from July 15th to August 6th. And it was a pretty important part of the war. Like, I don't want to call it like a TSN turning point, but it's kind of like coming to its apex here. So General Ludendorff again originally wanted to launch an offensive in Flanders, but finally the Allies were just too strong there. Like, they had been fighting this area, and like you said, they shortened up the line and they were kind of bringing everything together. So he ordered an attack on either side of Reims in mid-July. The area from Chateau Thierry eastward to Verdun had been pretty lightly defended by the Allies because most of the reserves were concentrated along the forward arc of the German salient. So the German strategy was to cross the Marne first and then quickly shift their heavy artillery and trench mortars northward for a Flanders offensive, which was called Operation Hagen. Little sidebar here. Where do they come up with the names for the operations? Like, you had Operation Michael, and we have Operation Hagen, and like, do you think somebody just like shouts out a word?
I don't know. It's interesting because Tavern and I were talking about this, but not in the context of the army. I think it was in the context of like the police or something. And they just, like, did, like, random alphabetical words. So maybe it was similar.
Yeah, maybe I
have no clue. It's not something I've deep dived into.
No, nor have I, obviously, but maybe I'll.
Because maybe Operation I'll take a look Michael at it. Doesn't sound very German.
No, not at all. Maybe it's like Michel. No, that's French. I don't know.
I don't know either. Unless that's like a Englishized version.
Anglicized?
Yep, that's weird.
All right, well, back from our sidebar here. So Ludendorff rejected the idea of going on the defensive. He was worried that it would let the Allies concentrate their now pretty superior resources and firepower onto one single battlefield. However, General Foch and the Allied command, or was the Allied commander, of course, was planning offensive operations of his own. The Allied attacks in June had revealed some weaknesses in the German resistance, and then there was also an influenza epidemic, which was called the Spanish flu, the 1918 flu, the Great Influenza, Disease 11, the Spanish Lady. There were so many names for this. And it was weakening some German forces pretty heavily. So despite the setback caused by the epidemic, the French began preparing for a counteroffensive, and this was scheduled for July 18th against both sides of the German salient. So they were going to kind of try to cut it in half there. So by mid-July, the German Crown Prince's group of armies, with support from a significant artillery force, prepared to attack along a 75-mile front from Argonne to Chateau Thierry. That's a huge front. Yeah, and facing them were around 70 divisions from four French armies, and this included some American, British, and Italian divisions. But the Germans kind of had an advantage when it came to the artillery. They were loaded up in that area. So the Second Battle of the Marne began on July 15th with a heavy artillery bombardment, as they always do. And the French had received advance intelligence on this, though, and they thinned out their front position, and they were able to counter the bombardment pretty effectively. East of Reims, the Germans had a major defeat by the French Fourth Army, which was a significant setback for the German commanders. However, on the west side of Reims, the German 7th Army established a bridgehead across the Marne, which led to some pretty fierce fighting when they were able to kind of get there and get across. So on July 18th, the French launched a counteroffensive with massive force, including four American divisions. They're in almost full tilt there now. And this was between Chateau Thierry and Inn. The attack caught the Germans by surprise, and by mid-afternoon, they had pushed the west face of the salient back 4 miles. Why did I do all this in miles? What? I don't know why I did that.
It's good to know both.
It's sure.
It's good.
Yeah. I'm going to blame whatever book I was reading. So the French advance forced the evacuation of the Marne bridgehead, so they were able to get them away from there. But as the battle continued, the Germans found themselves in a nasty defensive battle, which they really didn't want. And their planned Flanders offensive, Operation Hagen, was canceled. The Second Battle of the Marne raged on for almost 3 weeks, resulting in pretty big casualties for both sides. And by August 7th, the Germans had been pushed back behind the Vesle River, temporarily escaping the French pressure. They had lost thousands of prisoners and suffered tons of casualties. So Ludendorff's offensive strategy was pretty much a failure. The German armies were weakened and they were facing a pretty critical test coming up here. The Allies, on the other hand, had some pretty big advantages with well-rested British sector, like the Canadians, and a strong French presence on the front lines and in reserve. So the tide was kind of turning here, and we're, like I kept mentioning, you know, we're coming to that apex. We're coming to the end here in the next couple months. So the stage was set for the Allies to just sweep in and win this thing.
This year is just wild.
It is.
It's like at the beginning of 1918, the Allied commanders did not believe that this war was going to end in 1918. They fully anticipated that this would go well into 1919.
Mm-hmm.
And then they go through a phase where, like, they're beaten back quite a bit. They lose a fair chunk of land. And now the tides are just quickly turning. I'm like, oh my God, like, we covered, like, 8 months in one episode. Yeah. Like, this is just not normal. Like,
it's very dramatic.
Yes. Oh my God. But I know it's coming and I know it's going to slow down. So it's okay.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, now we're going to do like 17 more episodes in the last, like, what, 4 months?
We'll try not to do like the 3-part Passchendaele thing again.
Yeah. The next one is Amiens. Is that right? Is that what we're coming up to? Or
I think so. Yeah. I think so.
I, yeah. One of the, we're in the 100 days now, aren't we?
Yeah,
so we're in the last 100 days, so we've got a few battles coming up that are just going to end this thing.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
All right, well, thanks everyone for joining us. If you're interested in finding out more about us, please go to our socials. You can find us on Instagram and Facebook, and you can listen to us on Spotify, Google Podcasts, and Apple Podcasts.